Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's
local and loyal programming.
Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern, and the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan, and so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and you're listening to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. This 30-minute podcast features a new author interviewed by me every single day, 365 days a year, for about 30 minutes. I am also the publisher for Zibby Books, which publishes 12 books a year in fiction and memoir. Our books are already out now, and you can check it out on zibbybooks.com. And we have a magazine called Zibby Mag, where we have lots of wonderful essays and lifestyle features. That's at zibbymag.com. We have classes at zibbyclasses.com. And I recently opened a bookstore in LA called Zibby's Bookshop at 1113 Montana Avenue at 11th Street in Santa Monica. I hope that you are able to enjoy some of our other offerings, but this here podcast is the basis of all of it and started in 2018. And no matter what I do, this is basically my favorite thing. Enjoy. This is an exceptionally special episode to introduce because it's a conversation that happened at Zibby's Bookshop, which I watched on the live stream between my younger brother, Teddy Schwarzman, who is the producer of NIAID, and also Diana NIAID. It was amazing to watch. You can go to youtube.com/@Zibbyverse and watch it yourself, but you're here, so just listen to this. I'm so proud of my brother, Teddy. I call him Teds, but nobody else can. And I am just beaming. Watching him up there was such a thrill, and I'm just so proud of him. I adore him, and I'm so proud of him, and this whole thing just like completely warms my heart. So I hope that you enjoy the episode. I'm thrilled I can have him on the podcast. And yes, at the age of 64, Diana NIAID became the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida without the aid of a shark cage, swimming 110.86 miles in 53 hours from Havana to Key West. By the way, this is all in the Academy Award-nominated film NIAID,
for which I think both Jodie Foster and Annette Bening are nominated for Best Actress and Supporting Actress, or maybe just one of them. But anyway, it's nominated, and if you're watching the Academy Awards tonight, please root for them and for the film Naiad in general. More on Diana Naiad. In the 70s, she became known as the world's greatest long-distance swimmer with her open water achievements, including a record-breaking swim around Manhattan. For the next 30 years, Naiad was a prominent sports broadcaster and journalist, filing compelling stories for National Public Radio, ABC's Wide World of Sports, and others. She is the author of the best-selling memoir, Find a Way, and three other books. She is a national fitness icon, a talented linguist, the co-founder of Everwalk, and one of today's most powerful and engaging public speakers. She performed her off-Broadway show, The Swimmer, at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York City in 2019. A Netflix movie, Naiad, based on Diana's memoir, is currently enjoying global acclaim and features a tour de force performance by Annette Bening, who plays Diana, and an equally riveting turn by Jodie Foster, who plays Bonnie. My brother, Teddy Schwarzman, serves as president and CEO of Black Bear Pictures, which he founded, and oversees all operations of the company, including development, production, strategic planning. I'm getting this from IMDb, by the way. Schwarzman has produced a range of content, a sampling of which includes The Imitation Game, Academy Award winner for Best Adapted Screenplay, and nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Also, J.C. Chandor's All Is Lost, which earned Robert Redford the Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor, Suburbicon, and others. Schwarzman has also served as executive producer of Dee Reese's Mudbound, nominated for 4 Academy Awards, and Heidi Ewing's moving film, I Carry You With Me. He also produced ACOD, which I loved, with Adam Scott, and The Friend, which was amazing. And also Julia Roberts' movie, Ben Is Back. Those were amazing. Why are they not in his bio? A member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and Producers Guild of America, Schwarzman sits on the board of directors of Elevation Pictures Corp., one of Canada's leading film and television distributors. He also sits on the board of the Pacific Council on International Policy and the Cedars-Sinai Board of Governors. Schwarzman earned a Bachelor of Arts from the University of Pennsylvania and a Juris Doctor cum laude from Duke University School of Law, where he sits on the board of visitors. Enjoy the episode.
It's exciting. So everybody get ready for a wonderful night of storytelling. Well done.
Thanks everybody for being here. This is so exciting. True that you know, I was the producer of this project and honored enough to be able to help bring your story to life. But in this room, I do think being Zivi's brother probably sets me up as being even more accomplished or exciting. But this has been a labor of love for the filmmaking team of Naiad for the last 7 years, and really excited to now get to the point where we get to share our version of Diana's story with the world. But these events are really exciting, at least for me, because there's the movie, and then there's what inspires the movie, and there's the human behind the character, obviously portrayed by Annette Bening, but Diana and her best friend and confidant, and compadre along the way, Bonnie Stoll, who's here tonight. you live this. This film and some of the awareness in this room, although I'm sure not all, comes from the fact that there is now a new catalyst and something to watch. But you've inspired so many people with this incredible, incredible feat and just your will and sheer endurance of 110 miles.
110.86. Anybody can swim 110. It's that last 0.86 that's going to come.
53 hours?
52 hours, 54 minutes, 18 seconds. Okay, let's round it up.
At the age of 64. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah. Really. Yeah. So, I remember when it happened, and I also remember hearing about this as a potential film adaptation in 2017. And obviously the events took place in 2013. Mm-hmm. Right? And my question was, why? Why are you doing this? And why did you feel compelled at the age of 28? And why did you feel compelled at the age of 60, after 30 years not in the water, to pick back up on this dream? What was it about this dream?
You know, a lot of people who adventure in extreme places on planet Earth, whether it's trekking across Antarctica, walking the Sahara Desert, Jimmy Chin climbing all the mountains. It's usually something personal. It's something they either grew up in the shadow of Mount Everest or they saw something young and that was it. And for me, I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which in that era was where the boys are, and how ironic that I was looking for girls. But I already had a love affair with the ocean as a child. That was our playground, our family. And the Cuban Revolution broke when I was 9 years old. And literally overnight, those Cuban exiles had 24 hours to leave Havana, the rest of Cuba, with anything they could carry. And they came into my hometown. And so all of a sudden, we knew about Cuba. My parents had danced salsa in the Hotel Nacional, which was the party place of JFK and Jackie. So we knew Havana, people living in Miami, Fort Lauderdale. But all of a sudden, in 24 hours, that magical island was forbidden. And I was a little swimmer. I was a competent little 9-year-old pool swimmer. And I stood on the beach with my mother one day at nine at the point of the revolution. And I was just filled, as many of us were all around the world, with the mystique of that beautiful island, Cuba, that now was forbidden. And I said, "Mom, where is it? I know it's right out there, Cuba, but I can't see it." And she said, it's here. No, it's right here. It's right across Havana. It's right across the horizon. It's just a bit over the curvature of the earth. So you can't see it. But honestly, it's so close. It's that close that you little champion swimmer, you could almost swim there. And honestly, people say, "Oh, this was a 35-year story from age 28 when I first tried it over to 64 when Bonnie and I finally made it to the other shore." But the truth is, it went all the way back to age 9. I carried that little buzz in my imagination all those years. And then in my 20s, I became one of the best open water swimmers in the world. I held the records for around Manhattan Island, Capri di Napoli in Italy, across Lake Ontario. And there were other great swimmers as well. But in my mind, all those swimmers were in this category. If you tell me you've swum the English Channel, I have respect for you. But all those swims are over here in Cuba. Nobody had ever made it. It's not only a long distance, but you've got the conundrum of the Gulf Stream squeezing through the Yucatan Channel. And right here between Havana and Key West, that Gulf Stream is 85 miles wide, and it's going 6.6 miles an hour east, and you're going 2.2 miles an hour north. So it's easy to do the math. It's a very tricky, tricky navigational, challenge. And if you saw the movie or you read the book already, our beloved navigator, John Bartlett, was a mathematical genius, and he lived in those seas all his life. So he took us across, and he and Bonnie, she was on the boat that I was breathing. Imagine breathing to your left this way for 52 hours and 54 minutes, and the only thing you see is Bonnie.
What's your point?
Bonnie would pee right over the side of the boat. She wasn't going anywhere. She was my soldier. And then put that into the four other tries, 48 hours this time, 51 hours this time. What about all the training? 12 hours this day, 14 hours this day. Every breath was Bonnie. So believe me, it looked like one set of arms. Believe me, we did this together. Yeah.
I do.
So wait, I didn't get to the second half of your story, your question. So you can see it was a drive, and I tried it at age 28 when I was in the midst of that decade, the 1970s, which were my 20s of swimming, and didn't make it. The next year, the winds came out of the east for 91 days. You want to do this swim in the summer, when the waters are warmest, to give you the best chance. We missed that window. The next year comes, 1980, and we can't get visas to go into Cuba. And I gave it up. I don't mean I gave up, but I gave it up. I was getting offers from the wide world of sports and from Fox News and from National Public Radio. It's time, my time to make a living as a journalist and a storyteller. And I'm not going to complain about those 30 years, 30 to 60, following the best in the world, Tour de France, cyclists and U.S. Open tennis championships and Olympic Games. But toward the end of that 30 years, I had a tremendous malaise of not being a doer anymore. I wasn't chasing any big dreams. I was following other people chase their dreams. And my mom died. And I thought, whoa, how much time do I have left? I met Christopher Reeve. He had fallen from his horse. Mm-hmm. And now he was a quadriplegic. And Chris was very big on regrets. Yeah. You have no idea what banana peel you might slip on tomorrow. Don't wait. Chase your dreams right now. So I was kind of filled with all that, read the Mary Oliver poem. I don't know about you all. I personally don't understand poetry. Every poem I've ever read, when I get to the end of it, I say, can't they use just one or two more verbs? Something to get me through. But all of that was happening coming up to 60. And I thought, I'm going to give my job up. I don't care if I don't have any money in the bank. I'm going out and make that swim the goal of my one wild and precious life. So I guess at this speed, we can only have time for three questions.
That's true. And I promised from a Barbara Walters standpoint that I'll make you cry. Talk to us about failure, because I feel like everybody knows that you did this swim and that you accomplished your goal, but you also had to re-up your own determination so many times and live with trying to tackle these dreams or this singular dream that seemed to be deferred. How was it at after 28? How was it after swim two, swim three, swim four? Did you ever lose hope? And how did you find a way to continue to reinvest and to believe?
You know, it's like, it goes back to the Greeks, you know, who always spoke about the journey being more valuable than the destination. So you set off on difficult journeys, because the higher the bar and the more you're willing to have the courage to fail, you're going to discover who you are. The lower the bar, the more mediocre the bar, you won't get to know yourself at all. So this dream was swim was so epic, so difficult. Others had proven that before me, that I was just filled with the imagination of what we discover out there. Our team was 40 people, from the shark team to the jellyfish team to the navigation team to the medical team to Bonnie and her immediate team in charge of my life and my safety. And we were on a journey of discovery and of grand adventure. And honestly, I don't like to believe that I would have ever, you know, let it go and just been happy with the journey. But the truth is, each time you have to call it a failure because you didn't make it to the shore. You didn't get to where you said you're going to make it to. But the truth for us, it wasn't so much a failure. It was a journey. And like any journey we all take, I don't care whether you're battling cancer or you're trying to climb Annapurna and you don't make it, you get through with where you need to go and you have more intel and more science. You're on a learning curve and you go back. You don't just go back with the same procedure you had the first time and say, well, maybe we'll get lucky this time. Knowledge is power. And our team was smart, and we researched and we believed. So I never did lose hope. I never did. I mean, one of the funny moments Bonnie can tell you is after we didn't make it one time, and the crew is beat up. They're tired. When they drag me out, and by the way, Bonnie will tell you too, it was never me who said, I can't do it. I've bitten off more than I can chew. Mother Nature on steroids, whether it be the deadly box jellyfish or huge tropical storms that won't relent and are wearing 8 to 10 foot seas, were blown so far off course, is just like on Everest. If a 90 mile an hour wind comes, and there's the summit. It's right there. You don't say, well, it's mind over matter. I'm going to go. You're not going to get blown off Mount Everest. You're going to turn around and say, it's not my day. We'll come back another day. So we had to do that four times. We had the powwow with tears, with anger. It's not our day. 51 hours. It's not our day. We're going to have to come back another day. But I always like on not making it on the fourth time, I was lying on a boat deck, wrapped in a blanket and semi out of it. All the crew was down and out. We're sludging our way back to Key West. And I said, Bonnie, she said, what? I said, you know what we got to do? We've got to find the world's leading expert in the box jellyfish. And she came over and she said, could you give us a lousy 24 hours? You know, we just worked for a year. We're proud of ourselves. You know, we deserve a little rest and we deserve to just let this go. How about 24 lousy hours? And I said, okay. But 24 hours later, we were at it. We were at researching it and we found Dr. Angel Yanagihara.
And I know you gave us a visual of what it's like taking stroke after stroke and having Bonnie there, but to actually, I don't know that any of us can really understand and process 53 hours in the ocean. What's that like? and combine that with currents, with storms, with sharks, with jellyfish that had at a certain point stung you near death, and then you went back in and continued to go back and battle something that you knew could kill you. I mean, I'm scared to go about like 10 feet off the shore of the beach of what might be out there. What's it like just psychologically? How do you process it?
It's grand. You know, it is. It's a, you know, I haven't been in space, but honestly, when I hear and I read about astronauts talking about seeing that little, as Carl Sagan put it so poetically, that little blue speck, the blue dot that is the Earth. When we were out there, and you know, you always hear in this sport, for those of us like Sarah Thomas, who's done the English Channel four times consecutively, 54 hours in the English Channel. So there are three of us who do the long, long swims who have done. And yes, you hear about all the hardships and the grueling aspects of it, but the truth is there's nothing like it. You're actually swimming over the curvature of the Earth. You're traveling. You're looking up, and maybe you've read Stephen Hawking the night before, and you're looking up in the middle of the Gulf Stream on a summer night, on a clear night. You can see literally 2 billion stars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bonnie and I, it's so, you know, we sort of tripped us out. I'm used to having hallucinations, but I'm hoping Bonnie doesn't have any because she's got to keep things together. But right, Bonnie, on one night, we both saw giant fir trees, pine trees in the sky. You know, first I said it and she said, oh my God, that's what I'm seeing too. Huge trunks that go over the entire horizon with giant boughs this way. Then from the hallucinations to the thinking of their childhood is wafting to the Stephen Hawking of the stars. You are immersed in this blue jewel of a planet of ours. You're immersed in it. And so I'm not that swimmer anymore. There are other things I want to accomplish in my life, and that was the Holy Grail, Cuba. So, Teddy, you and I could take the globe, and it's blue, and we could say, well, look, there are 1,000 places you could swim. But in my 20s, I swam a lot of them, and Cuba was it. So now I want to be other things, do other things, but I don't think I will ever, it could bring me to tears, I don't think I'll ever have that sense of grandeur. You know, it's not an ego thing. It's an actual, we prepared for it, we trained for it, and we are capable of actually swimming that whole beautiful distance between that historic place, Cuba, and Florida. When I got to meet President Obama, whom I admire terribly, I was in the Oval Office with him, and he said, you know, because, you know, one of his, you know, sort of goals was to bring our two countries back together. He said, you showed us, your gesture was to leave this shore and shortly thereafter touch this shore. And why can't we in a short time bring our two beautiful peoples back together? So there's a lot to it out there, you know, and I don't want to try to go recreate it. It could never be as magical as it was.
Well, I think what you've done might have felt singular to you and collective in the team experience that you went through in order to reach the other shore. But I feel like I'm hearing so many people these days tackle problems, big and small, and then say, well, if Diane and Nyad can do that swim, right? Like, I can get on the treadmill. I can deal with this issue at work. I can deal with whatever issues are happening. I'm hearing so much of the, well, if Diane and Nyad could do it. But what did it mean to you to reach the other shore and to achieve your dream? And what do you want other people to feel from that?
On the strictly internal, personal end of it, honestly, stumbling up onto that shore was not a big, magnificent ego moment. Like, we did it. We finally did it. What I felt was the profound satisfaction of not having ever given up on it. You know, those five attempts were grueling, and they all took a lot of year-long training, you know, to each one. And so I remembered literally standing on that shore, and it was you know, you were reeling, you know, with all the people. It was very, very hot out. Bonnie was there, and I almost collapsed at one point. And I remember thinking, flashing on looking at the alarm clock in St. Martin. We got up at 2 a.m. one day because we wanted to start a swim at 4. We had a 16-hour swim plan that day. We wanted to start at 4. And I remember looking, you know, you're in this cocoon in your bed, and you know that you're going to hurt that day. And you've decided that Bonnie and I together have decided this is what this day needs, 13 hours, 16 hours, we decide. And I remember...
This is the training sequence.
Training.
Right, yeah.
I remember flashing on that alarm clock, like watching the clock and thinking, oh, it's only 1:58. I have 2 more minutes to be warm and cozy. I don't want to get up yet. But when it came to be 2 o'clock, we set the schedule. We're the ones who set the training. You know, we could go to the movies that day. We could just, you know, say, fuck off. We're not going to train today. But we never did. We never took a day off. We did the hours that we thought were going to leave no stone unturned to give us a chance to get across if Mother Nature let us. But you're leading to something else, Teddy, and that is that I was aware. I was aware back in 1978, and I was aware when I wasn't making the swim, you know, in modern times, that other people were following. And yes, there is some, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, but there's some admiration level to it. But the truth is, what we hear from, and now that the movie is so successful, so beautiful, so powerful, we're hearing from hundreds and hundreds of people around the world, people with Parkinson's, young people who want to do something big with their lives, from China, from Chile, from Wyoming. And what could mean more? Yes, I'm kind of blown away. This movie has my name. I mean, how often does that happen? You know, how often do you get, you know, a tour de force set of performances from people like Annette Bening and Jodie Foster? So, you know, yeah, the movies, we're rooting for them so hard for their Oscars, you know, their SAG Awards. But in the end, what really touches me most deeply is people being inspired. And because we're no longer, you could tell us better, but we're no longer in that movie sort of era where a movie's at the movie theater, and if it does well, it's there for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and then it's gone. But now, because of streaming, people are going to see this movie for a long, 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 long time. And we're so lucky to think that people are inspired by it. You know, I haven't, I keep mentioning Bonnie, but there's another person in the room I want to mention. And that's my dear, dear friend, a kick-ass tennis player, and my literary agent who brought this book to life. And that's Amy Renner. Stand up. Amy. Can you see her skinny little legs? You know, look at these little legs over there. You can't believe her running on the tennis court. She's like a mosquito. She zipped over there and she zipped over there. She's a fantastic player.
Oldest person ever to get a 5.0 rating for the first time.
There we go.
That's my NIAID moment.
This is a very accomplishment.
And by the way, Bonnie's a pretty good tennis player herself. Yeah.
I feel like that's a wonderful segue from, you know, one seemingly lonely endeavor in a marathon swim to another lonely endeavor in writing a book, which is how was the experience? How did you find the experience of trying to put your story down on paper? I mean, I've read your book. If anybody here hasn't, it's wonderful. And I think
it's really you
not only feel the experience of just the gigantic obstacle of what you were trying to achieve, but you also really you're very vulnerable in the book, and you give us a great sense of who you are, who you think you are, who you've evolved to, your youth, a lot of things that are hard to write about. And I think you write about it with a wonderful level of self-awareness and vulnerability that I think just adds to the experience of the amazing accomplishment that you achieved. But what was it like just having to figure out how to write a book? And I'm sure there's a number of people in here who not only are huge fans of literature since you're at a bookstore, but maybe authors themselves, and just that experience.
You know, there are memoirists. I love the word memoir. You know, it's better than autobiography.
It's but very fancy.
There are memoirists. I mean, Diane Keaton's one, for example, who write many different sections of their life, you know, in books. And I didn't know if I'd ever write another one, you know. So I thought, I really do want to include philosophies of life, my atheism, hopefully, you know, other values that I have and a whole realm of life experiences. And I never did, oddly enough, I don't know how many pages the book is. Is it 400 pages? But the hardback, I never did make an outline. I never did. I just sat down. And I, as a speaker, for instance, I'm lucky I go around the world. Bonnie and I did a show off Broadway, you know, right before the pandemic. So I am something of a storyteller. And in this book, I wanted to, even though it's nonfiction, I wanted to take you with me. I wanted to, as a good storyteller, you take people to the sounds and the visuals and the smells of where you are, and bring them on the journey with you through the book. So I kind of, Amy can tell you, I kind of furiously got to it because the swim was over. And the movie can come out anytime, you know, as you've proven 10 years later, it's not too late for that movie. But the book, you after a real event, evidently in the world of publishing, you need to come out fairly quickly. So I had my computer on planes and hotel rooms. I was just getting it done, but I'm the type, I don't know about you all, but I'm the type that second guesses everything. Nothing is ever good enough. I look back at every relationship, every day, everything I do and say, why didn't I do it this way? I could have done it this way. But that book, I have to say, it's not perfect, of course. But I felt very proud of it. And I still do. I don't have this overwhelming feeling of, I wished I had done this with it. I you know, how about that part over there? I'll write other books. And I'm actually working on my first children's book. It's going to be hopefully a series for middle school kids. And just like I'm famous for saying, as I said on the beach at the end, you're never too old to chase your dreams. Well, this series of children's books, I hope, will be called You're Never Too Young to Chase Your Dreams. So it's about little kids who are like 9 years old saying, why should I wait till I go to graduate school? I want to do that right now. And they do, hopefully. So I'm working on that. But the point is that I feel proud of the book. It's one of the few things in my whole life I haven't second-guessed.
It's a very good book.
And I want to also say Diana's one of the few people to accomplish something so extraordinary and write her own book. Every word in this book is your book. There's no ghostwriter, there's no collaborator, there were good friends and editors, but these are your words, and it's an extraordinary memoir, and it really doesn't matter if you read the book first or see the film first.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight.
As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
You may not know this, but the book is for sale here.
Your sister will be so proud, and
I would suggest you buy it. Let's go Hollywood inside baseball for a second. You had to trust people that you knew hardly at all to take your story and adapt it into a cinematic experience, recognizing that has a profound effect on you. You did so without having any approval rights over how you appeared in the film, and did it, I think, based on fit and a little bit of luck. But that must have been really hard and kind of scary. And also the process of actually developing a feature film and how either quickly or slowly that can move, I'm sure is also frustrating when it's not something that you're personally driving the entire way. Tell us about it.
Well, you use the term inside baseball, so let's get down. You know, I've never lost the sort of umbrella emotion of gratitude. Never. When, you know, to have, these are all world-class people, and I don't know if you know Teddy Schwartzman, but we're talking about The Imitation Game. I mean, some of the great movies of the last couple of decades, Teddy has had the vision for and produced, and his partner on this, Andrew Lazar with American Sniper, you know, some very high-level, beautiful films. And now let's talk about the actors we already have, but not to leave out Reese Ifans, who plays our John Bartlett brilliantly in this movie, sort of overshadowed by the two women leads. But Bonnie and I have come to tears in calling Reese to tell him, you know, what we felt about his magnificent performance. And then, you know, the cinematographer is Claudio Miranda. I don't know if you ever saw The Life of Pi, you know, with the tiger in the ocean. That's his visual vision. He's the director of photography. Did I say cinematographer? Yeah. I meant director of photography.
It's the same.
And, you know, he did the Avatar movies. He did Top Gun Maverick, you know, to see that plane going through the canyons. So he, with his special effects team, and I just made a video to thank them today because they won some big award last night. They made the ocean that majestic infinitude, that raging and yet peaceful place that Bonnie and I fell in love with. And so the movie is gorgeous. Who's the underwater photographer?
Pete Zuccherini.
Pete Zuccherini did all the underwater shooting, and we could go on with the composer, everybody. Bonnie and I are from the world of sports, and we know a lot of world-class athletes. But the people who worked on this movie, they're all, including Teddy, starting with Teddy and Andrew, are at the upper echelon, you know, of the movie business. So it's never escaped me to have the movie carry my name, to portray this lifelong friendship with Bonnie, to show the grit that I truly have. And then on the other hand, if you want to get down, because how are you ever going to be happy with a movie of your life? You know, how are you ever going to say, there's nothing else that they need? You know, you won't. It's just human nature that the only aspect that was very difficult, and Teddy knows this, we had many, you know, into the night conversations about this, I was something, if I can use the terms, of a visionary. I had this vision. And I brought, then with Bonnie too, this team together, the John Bartletts. And this was 40 people who were believers. They drank the Kool-Aid of my words and my emotions. And Bonnie and I commandeered this together. And in some ways, I understand, because a movie has to be just a slice of life. It's not a huge, wide, sweeping documentary. So I have to forgive that right away and be at peace with that. On the other hand, the one aspect that just always rankled me was that the Annette character was portrayed by the writer, and then the executive producers and the directors decided that this is what they wanted, to make her, me, quite the dimension of unapologetic, relentless, I'm going to do this, I don't care, nothing's going to get in my way, and all of that's powerful. The audience who see this film, they wind up, all of them around the world, walking out or in their homes writing us to say, I want to be more like that character. They admire that character. But for me, I'm a bit more, shall we say, charismatic than that character. So I to be truthful, I had trouble with that. And we talked about it before shooting ever started. But Teddy and Andrew and the writer and the actors, they held with their vision. And it took me a while. And I kind of lucky the strike happened. Because had the strike not happened, I would have been a blabbermouth, and I would have made this point to the press. But because the strike happened, I couldn't talk about the movie at all. And I came to peace with the audiences appreciating it. I came to peace with...
I think we might have some press in the room.
No, that's okay. No, because I assume that some people will tell this story after.
Right.
I'm not afraid to say it. And you shouldn't be afraid to hear it. Because
I have heard it.
Yeah. So I'm trying to make the bigger point that I let go. This is their movie, and it's a beautiful movie, and it's an inspiring movie. And can I be absolutely okay with the way my character's portrayed? Yes, I'm with it. I'm absolutely with it. But I'll just be honest with you, in those first few months, I struggled with that part. And I think the reason they make biopics about people who are dead is because they're not around to, make their suggestions. And I was not given any control over the film. And in the end, they made it their way, and they made it brilliantly.
Well, I would also say the hope, and probably the greatest ambition, is to make a film that the subject, if you want to use that word, will be proud of and will feel has done never the perfect job, but a job that does their achievements or their life or their essence proud. And knowing that the people who are behind telling that story are trying to do it not only for narrative reasons, but to honor the subject and to honor the relationships and to honor the achievement. And I think from everybody who was involved in trying to craft your life into a 2-hour film, I think there was a combination of awe, respect, admiration, and love for who you are and what you have achieved. And I think at the same time, one of the things that we found so unique to your story was also this incredible friendship that you've shared with Bonnie for 40 plus years, and the yin and yang of your relationship. And so anybody who asks me, well, is Diana like that? I say, yes. But she's also even more inspiring. And I think that's true. But I do think that, and again, we're now just waxing our own personal opinions. I think while Annette's character certainly can be acerbic at times and focused with her own relentless pursuit, I think what people leave that film with, hopefully, and it's great to just talk about your own film instead of having other people talk about it, but it is that speech at the beach, is that gratitude, is that appreciation for friendship, for family, either chosen or found, but also an inspiration that it's not just about your accomplishment, but about people of a certain age, women of a certain age, people in general, not giving up on their dreams and finding a way, as cheesy as that sounds with the book title, Find a Way. So I can't ever imagine giving up my life into somebody else's hands to tell that story. That has to be so impossible. But I have to say, despite the fact that you complained every step of the way. you did so fairly and with a desire to ensure that the film that we were putting into the world would leave people with the same level of inspiration that you hoped your actual swim had, and the fact that you had inspired time and time again 40 plus people to put their jobs on hold, to put their lives on hold, and to focus on something greater than themselves. So kudos
and
to you.
And you did. So in the end, the bottom line, because we're just here to really dig down and, you know, share every little kernel. But in the end, I'm so damn proud of this movie. Mm-hmm. It's rock on. I don't know if I ever told you this, but way before I'd met Teddy, I knew Andrew already. Bonnie and I have a friend in the movie business who's done some, you know, a lot of big movies, Quiz Show, and et cetera. And I said one day, Gail, you know, I'm not an actress per se, but I do get on stage and I tell stories and I use foreign accents and whatnot. Should I screen test to play myself? And Gail took a pause and she said, well, you only have to ask yourself one question. Do you want anyone to see the movie? And I said, oh, well, you don't have to hit me over there with a hammer. She said, Diana, you can go and talk to groups in Tokyo and you can do the off-Broadway. People go to the movies because they want to see a movie star. And we got a movie star.
Yeah. Now to that end, and honestly, I feel like we can, I guess before we transition to questions, I feel like we were supposed to shoot on a very quick schedule from the time that Annette Bening and Jodie Foster signed onto the project, and then due to Netflix coming on board the project and hurricane season that we probably should have accounted for, we pushed our schedule an extra 9 months, which gave Annette about a year of training time to really try to match the incredible physical prowess that you had. But I think in that time, you also got to really work with Annette and Jodie, and the four of you would get together on a fairly regular basis to really get to know each other so they could try and distill something more of an essence of a relationship and a dynamic. But what was that process like?
You know, it was just wonderful. I mean, these two people, I can't speak for the rest of, you know, the acting world, but both of them, these two people, as different as they may be, are grounded, sincere, lovely, funny, smart people. You know, if you all would sit down with dinner with them, there's nothing movie star about them at all. And Bonnie spent more time with Jodie, and I spent more time with Annette, and then the four of us, you know, spent time together. And, you know, people are sort of naive because they ask us and say, well, you know, did they take videos of you and see if you sit with your finger like this on your cheek? And they did none of that. They were just getting to know us. We got to know each other's dogs and families, and we ate dinners together and shared a lot of laughs and sincere talks. And that's son is a transgender individual. And I had certain, you know, opinions about transgender women competing against women athletes, cisgender athletes. And we had really deep philosophical talks about that. And I came to a place, and Annette and I respected each other over that. So there were just lots of different issues, and it was wonderful. One hysterical thing happened on the set. Bonnie and I got to the set. You guys shot everything in the Dominican Republic. Everything. They created Cuba, New York City, Key West, Los Angeles. It was all right there in the
all
Dominican
within 10 miles of Mondolio, Dominican Republic.
Yeah, yeah. So Jodie, and as I say, we knew each other quite well, all of us. Jodie came off the set. She wasn't going to work for an hour or so. So she and Bonnie and I were just walking along, and she had these necklaces like this that were inside her T-shirt. And just as a discomfort, she pulled them out and she put them out like this. And we're walking, and Bonnie stopped her and she said, That's odd. I have a piece very similar to that my father gave me. And Jodie said, no shit, Bonnie. That's what we're doing here. We are, I am you. We had these necklaces replicated. They were the necklaces. And at that very moment, Annette was sitting on a stool about twice the length of this stool. She was about to do an interview, and she was wearing what I used to wear, like a white shirt with a cube across and short shorts. And Jodie says to us, now see, Look at Annette over there. Do you think she wants to wear her hair? No. No, she's trying to be Diana. So that's what we're doing there. So, anyway, we had fun and we had depth. And we will be friends forever. The four of us.
Well, thank you. This was amazing. I feel like we have time for questions, if anybody has any. I don't see any hands. No. Yes, Bonnie. I'm realizing you should sit here. Let's have the two of
no,
you guys sit for just a little bit for questions, because I assure you they're going to be for you guys. Please.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell us some of the rules of that swim?
Yeah.
Like, you just eat with a tube in your mouth. You never get out ever. No one can touch you. What are some of the rules?
She can't touch the boat, and we can't touch her. But some of the rules were no sarcasm. It never works with 40 people. I don't want to know what she or he did wrong. People will handle it themselves. Okay. Don't tell on people. It's just gossipy and silly. It never works. And another rule was never, if you get the chance to speak to Diana, tell her what time it is, how many hours she's been in the water, how many more miles from shore are we? Because it changes every minute because of that Gulf Stream. But we on the crew were mesmerized every day. Diana never saw the dolphins and the turtles and it was fabulous, really.
But I think you're asking also about technical aspects of a swim.
Oh, you were, I missed that part.
And you know, just the basics are that you are not going to have any aid in either moving, propelling forward, so that would be fins or holding on to some sort of rope or being pushed from the back, or in flotation. So if you're going to stop and you're going to tread water, as Bonnie says, you're never allowed to touch the boat or touch the kayaks, but you can reach out and get a camelback hose and tread water and take fuel down. You can take a, you know, whatever we have to eat and take it down. But you can't be held up so that you could rest. You know, so you can't be helped in flotation or propulsion. And that's basically what an unaided swim is. Yeah.
Did you ever read the script before you guys film the movie?
Yeah. And Julia Cox is a...
Well, she got nominated by the Writers Guild. Yeah. That was really cool.
It's a Writers Guild nomination?
Writers Guild Best Adapted Screenplay.
That's really cool.
Nomination came out yesterday.
Yeah.
At which point did you read the script? Was that early on? Was
you know,
closer?
I actually wrote the first version of the script, and I'm a writer, but I realized very early on, I'd been working on it for about 6 months. They say in the movie business that a good script is taught. I don't know what the antonym is taught is, fat, but my script was fat. And I called Andrew Lazar one day and I said, what's our goal here? Is for me to become a screenwriter, which I didn't want to become. I just thought I knew this story well. Or should I let go and we'll get an A-list screenwriter who really knows what they're doing and help bring this inspiring story up? So I gave it up. There was another script and everybody passed on that. And then this young woman, Julia Cox, came in and she's a good writer and she's sensitive. And, you know, I mean, Teddy and Andrew had said they've seen a lot of scripts that was, didn't you say, Teddy, was one of the best scripts you'd read in a long time?
Yes. And I would say the first script we had was also very interesting. And you despised it. And I think tonally it was very different and a little more poppy, a little more almost Big Short, you know, I, Tanya, break the fourth wall. That felt that was very well crafted, but just tonally felt wrong. But it was good enough to get for us to be able to submit to some interesting directors.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Chin and Chai Vassarelli, the directing team, read it, said, we love the story. We don't like this script. And then we went and we found Julia, who wrote a new draft from scratch that we worked on very closely. And I think, you know, was something that we wanted to share with you once we thought it was ready. And I think Diana and Bonnie both weighed in on factual inaccuracies. I think Diana continued to, I think in your head, you always had Chariots of Fire as a comp. And I think we tried to say, if you made Chariots of Fire today, no one would watch it. So how do we do something that is more reflective of the personalities and the times while still being inspiring?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's back there? Way, way back.
Okay, I have a question. This is sort of for Bonnie. What brought you into this project? I mean, I know you've been friends, but what did
Well, at first it was the tan that I was going to get, if I'm honest. But when Diana brought it up, and I wouldn't commit to anything unless I would see something about it in person. So I went to Mexico for a training swim. And, you know, I saw what my best friend does best. And that was beautiful.
And I'm sorry to back that up a little bit. In 1980, it was the era, I don't know if you all remember, if you got into racquetball, but it was the era when racquetball had its heyday in the United States. There were glass courts, all the real aerobics, you know, centers had gone over to racquetball. There was a professional tour, men's tour, women's tour, and those athletes were hot at that time. They were well known. They had contracts. And so I went to play in my first professional racquetball tournament. I wasn't very good, and I knew I was going to lose quickly. And a friend told me, when you go, you will lose quickly. So you got to go see this woman named Elaine Lee. She's such a fiery player. She's really exciting. So I lost quickly. I went and got a lunch, and I heard all this screaming down at the glass court at this club. And I went down, and I sandwiched in. People are yelling. This Elaine Lee is like going horizontal across the court with her hand, with her body off, grabbing, you know, shots like this. And I she was so exciting to watch, a really dynamic athlete. And I said to the guy sitting next to me, "Where's that Elaine Lee from?" And he said, "That's not Elaine Lee. That's Bonnie Stoll from Connecticut." So we met that day, and I'm not sure, we have to do some research of it, but I became Bonnie's fitness coach very quickly. And 35 years later, we switched roles, and I became the athlete, and Bonnie became my coach. So I don't know that there's another story of that in the world of men's or women's sports.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes?
Thanks for the wonderful conversation. I have a question. Could you talk about the sense of self versus team on this journey? You talked about the motivation being deeply personal, but at the same time, obviously, convincing a team of people to join you on the mission. So is there like that separation of self versus team, and then that consciousness of like, oh, are all of this group of people supporting me, or are we doing this together?
I think honestly, you know, a big question when I finally made it was, well, how could you possibly do this at age 64 when you couldn't do it at age 28? And one, we did train differently, and we knew more about nutrition. Or, you know, it took us 5 times to learn more about the whole navigation, you know, and the jellyfish and the currents and all that. But I think the paramount difference was that when I was younger, I was more blustery and I was more ego oriented. And I was like, I'm doing this, you know, and I came over to knowing that I couldn't do it without the team. And so, yes, I was the one, you know, doing that hard work, the body athlete work, but the whole team, starting with Bonnie, but John Bartlett, as I say, all of them, they all played an integral part. And we really, you know, each had a role. They all had a role. Mine was in the water, but their roles were significant to getting across. Well, we just don't know what it is, like the paparazzi. Who do we talk to next? Yes?
How you mentioned sort of between your first attempts and then the more recent ones, sort of the malaise in between, and how did you find the motivation to do that? And then how are you finding the motivation now after the fact to do whatever's next and find that next passion?
Yeah. You know, I don't know Serena Williams, but let's just surmise that she's living a great life, children, great husband, businesses, friends, but I would surmise that she will never know the high octane drama and thrill of playing in front of those thousands of people at a night match at the US Open, of having thousands of people around the world admire her as the best woman player, maybe one of the best players who's ever lived. So sports are cruel that way. You succeed when you're young, and it's a tragedy that you probably won't feel that again. So I was lucky to come back into at an older age and get that again. But I'm 74 now, and I'm pretty vital, you know, a lot of energy. I've got goals and dreams, and I work on them, you know, with fierce fire every day, but probably the Cuba swim's the biggest thing I ever did. And it's hard to try to drum up, you know, that same depth of, as I say, high octane life that you had as an athlete. But when you say, how did I get motivated? I mean, I wasn't in a state of malaise for the 30 years. I was enjoying that career as a sportscaster. It was at the upper echelon of ABC Sports and National Public Radio. And I was telling stories about great, great people doing, you know, extraordinary things. But I got to the end of that 30 years, turning 60, feeling like, but I'm just talking about other people. You know, right. And storytelling should be enough in itself. It is, you know, it's a career. It's a career. And I'm in that career. But there was something in me who wanted to go back. That dream was unfinished. And it had started at age 9. And I always felt it dangling out there. So it wasn't hard to get motivated for it at all. Yeah.
Sorry.
In the film, there's a few mentions of like a mental playlist of songs that were going on in your head while you're swimming. But I was really wondering what your real like mental preparation was, you know, for those long, long swims.
You know, thank you. And this is, by the way, Sibby's brother.
I'm Zibby's husband, actually.
Oh, excuse me.
Kind of
stand up and say hello. Tell your name.
Hi.
Excuse me, Zibby's husband.
Hi.
You know, I don't think there's any better mental preparation to swim for 53 hours than swimming 16 hours and 18 hours and 20 hours and 24 hours. And, you know, then now you're immersed in it. You know how to get through those long hours. And so, like a lot of Ed Viestiers is a friend of mine. I don't know if you know him, but he's a good friend of Jimmy's. But he's climbed Everest more than any human being the pure way without bottled oxygen. And I asked Ed at one time, because a lot of runners and cyclists, I'm sure you all do this, swimmers especially, because you don't have much visual or audio input. So you're in the interior of your mind. So you start counting. And you start singing just to get through the hours. And I make goals, long-term goals. I could take a song like Janis Joplin's version of Me and Bobby McGee, and I would sing it 1,000 times, the whole song, from the first note to the last. And it would take me 9 hours and 45 minutes to sing all that way. But I asked Ed Viestiers once what he sings up on the mountain as he ran. And he said, I only have one song. And I was picturing he's up at the top of the world. He must be singing John Lennon's Imagine. He said, no. I sing, oh, the bear went over the mountain. So my songs were, my playlist is of my generation. It's Bob Dylan and Neil Young, especially, you know, out there in the middle of the night. I can hear that. You're not allowed headphones because headphones, you know, take away from the discipline that your mind has to have to get through those hours. So that's against the rules of the sport. But I could hear that eerie in the middle of the night, especially that you know, that Neil Young falsetto. I hear you knocking at the cellar door. And I mean, it would just sweep me away, even though I'm just hearing it in my head. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yes.
It came out today that we're like at a 10-year low of women characters in feature films. And I would love to hear what both of you think about the fact that this movie is not only about primarily two women, but two women who are over 60.
Do you want to address that first? I had no idea that there's a dearth of women characters at the moment, strong women characters.
We just thought it was a great story, and there are so many amazing actors of a certain age, women in particular, who don't get great roles anymore after they're past their perceived prime. And it's not a great talking point for two lead male producers in our 40s and 50s, but we're just very sensitive. And I just thought, my God, these women are incredible. These women are incredible, and the story deserves to be told, whether it's what feels like it's in vogue or not. People are going to be inspired by the story, and that's a testament to you. And luckily, that allows you know, Annette to be the one person, you know, over 40, I think, who's nominated for an Academy Award this year. So.
Yeah, no.
Or, and Jody, sorry, I was thinking of Best Picture.
Yeah,
Jody. I think what add to that is to say, you know, we could break it down and say how many 64, and that was 64, my age when I did the swim when she shot the movie. And she's in a bathing suit for 2 hours. And,
well,
and but there's
35 days.
And, yeah, and there's never any, you know, shallow reporting of this. You know, her grit, and by the way, she looks great. I mean, she was not a swimmer. You know, she was never afraid of the water, grew up in San Diego. She had worked on a fishing boat in high school or college. So she wasn't afraid to dive in there, but she never had a freestyle stroke. She never swam on a swim team. And for her to dedicate herself, she had an Olympic swimmer, Rheta Owens, who worked with her. And I was with her a bit also. But, you know, for her to be absolutely unabashed about, I am playing this swimmer who wears a bathing suit, who goes out fiercely to swim, you know, 12 hours in the pool and 14 hours in the ocean. She made it as I was at 64. Was I embarrassed to come out on the shore in a bathing suit at 64? No. And so I think that she clearly rose above all that. And nobody who ever reviews the movie talks anything about anything but her being this athlete, you know?
She's so swimming. She found a passion at this at this time in life, and it's really kind of fabulous. She swims every day.
Yeah, she does. She loves it. Yeah.
Well, I think we have to wrap it up now, but Diana and Bonnie will stick around.
I gotta say one more thing, and that is that, you know, Teddy, you could tell me, but friends of ours in the movie business say to us, you have no idea how strong the commitment must have been from your producers to take this on and move quickly through getting the actors, getting Netflix, getting it shot. You know, usually you linger around for, you know, a couple of decades and things fall apart. And the fact that you had the faith in me, in Bonnie, in our story, I'll never forget you for it, Teddy. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.